Then you put a third nut, and then you go through the PVC pipe with another plate and another nut. Do you follow, Dick? Over.
Yes, I've got that one. But now I'm worried about the fact that you've got a quarter 20 bolt going through the PVC pipe, and I guess the rope you're going to run down there goes onto one side of that bolt. I'll wait 2 seconds beyond the beep, Mel. Go ahead.
Well, the rope doesn't go up the center of the PVC pipe. No, it's outside. It's just on the pulley. It's just the pulley. It ties off. I tie it off down towards the bottom of the tree. The rope just passes through. This rope that I use is what they use to pull up the sail on my sailboat. I used to winch up the main sail, the main and sail was winched up with this rope, Dick. It's a marine type of rope. Over.
KC2, QAQ with a comment.
Go ahead, Glenn, and wait for the right number of seconds.
See, I've done what very, very similar to what Mel did. Very interesting, because I never discussed this with Mel before. But interesting thing that at the top of the PVC pipe, what I did was I got a stainless steel threaded hook. But it's not a hook. It's actually like a ring on the end. In other words, it's like a tie-off ring and with a threaded bolt on the other end, 3/8. And basically I took and it's actually stainless steel. You can get them in Ace Hardware. And at the end, what I did was I just took a flat washer and put it on the back half where the nut was going to go, between the nut and the PVC. So I drilled a hole about, I think it's about 1.5 inches below the top of the PVC pipe, and drilled the 3/8 hole. So it just kind of fit through the hole, kind of through the PVC, a little bit on the snug side. Put the flat washer on the outside. But here's the key. The nut that I used on the outside is one of those, it was a stainless steel nut, but it's one of those self-locking type with the nylon on the inside. So I kind of held the eye ring and then just tightened the nut down just a few threads beyond the end so that the thread wouldn't back off. And basically it just sits in the PVC pipe, and then this way I can attach the pulley to that ring on the outside, and it's a very secure, and nothing really works or pulls away on it, Dick. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
The ring as you describe it with a 3/8 bolt on it, would you call that a 3/8 eye bolt?
I think that's the correct name. That's what I was trying to think of, but I'm not completely sure with all my hardware, but I'm pretty sure that that's called as an eye bolt.
And then the pulley itself has a hook on it, and that hook goes through the eye bolt. Is that the way it's hooked together?
Yes, sort of yes and no. What I had to do is I had to use a small piece of Dacron rope and tie it off in between. That's that UV rope that you're talking about, which is just a little bit better than nylon, because nylon stretches, Dacron doesn't, and it's much better holding up against UV. So it's I had to tie between the ring and the pulley with a little bit of that Dacron, and then of course the rope that I actually go to the insulator, and then down the pulley I also use a large length of the Dacron rope. You can get the stuff at like DX Engineering. Or most of these, every time you go to a ham fest, they always have the Dacron tie-off rope. It's really good stuff, Dick.
As I see it, you're using the PVC pipe as both a support structure and a kind of a spring against the tree, if it's a tree. In your particular case, what is the diameter of the PVC pipe? How many feet long is the PVC pipe? And how many feet of it is bound to the tree? I mean, you could have started off with a piece of pipe, let me pick a number, 7 feet long, and the first 2 or 3 feet is bound to the tree, and the next 4 feet is not bound to the tree, and it becomes the spring. Is that and the rope itself, in your case, comes from the support rope, comes from the pulley straight down, and you tie it off at the base of the tree. The rope doesn't necessarily go down the center of the PVC pipe. Is that approximately true? Glenn, over to you, Glenn.
That's pretty much it, Dick. Except that the diameter of the pipe is 1.5 inches PVC. It comes in 10-foot lengths. I didn't cut it. I found that, to work with a 10-foot length, climbing up a tree and, putting it up somewhere on a, finding a pretty secure part of the tree near the top where I want to tie it off. And then basically what I did was when I wanted to hold it in place, this 10-foot section, I brought some wire ties with me. So I just carried it up there with the pulley already attached and the wire kind of already, the rope already through the pulley, and carried it up into the tree, found a good strong limb way up on the top, and then basically tied it off very quickly with a set of wire ties. Let me let it drop for a second. Then after just holding it in place with the wire ties to get it, you know, in a location where I liked, and then eyeballed it up, then I went back up there with more of that Dacron rope and kind of wrapped it around the bottom 5 feet of that PVC pipe and just kind of like wrapped it around and tied it off spirally between the tree limb and that pipe just to secure the bottom 5 feet, and this way allowing the top 5 feet to kind of spring, give it a little bit of spring action to work with the tree. And I said, no, that's been up there since about 2006. So, and I haven't any problem with the wire antennas, that's for sure. I think as I told you last March with some of the steel pipes in the high winds, I had some problem there, but all the wire antennas stood up, Dick. Back over to you, K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
A little different, Dick.
Mel recognized. Glenn, each time you pick up, wait about a second or two beyond the beep just to make sure everything resets. As you know, the tree is going to be growing, and no matter where you mount something on a tree, the girth of that area will slowly increase. Do you think your mounting mechanism will accommodate the girth increase of the tree? It may take 10 years to happen, but the girth of the tree is going to slowly increase in the area where you did this mounting, and the rope is bound around the tree. Do you think everything that can accommodate that increase in girth? Over to you, Glenn, first.
I think so, Dick, and the reason I say that is because I've kind of gone up there every once in a while just to inspect it to see what's going on and just to keep an eyeball on it every once in a while, and nothing up there really moves around a whole heck of a lot, but I don't think that in other words, even the original wire ties when I put them in, it's not like a machine, you know, fitting or like when you're working on a tower where, you know, bolts and clamps go together. When you put the wire ties around the outside, they're kind of loose. And the same thing even with the Dacron rope when it goes around the outside. There's so much surface area along 5 feet on a inch and a half diameter that you really didn't have to pull it tight, so tight that it, that you're strangling the tree. It's kind of just like wrapped around there. And I mean, if you get a look at this thing, you kind of get an idea. It's not going to move anywhere, but it's not super tight either, if you know what I'm saying. And there's plenty of spring action between the limbs and the bending of that PVC that the wire is really protected well. Back over to you, Dick.
What you call wire tie, which is what you attached first between the tree and the PVC pipe, is it really wire or is it metal strapping? And what stops the PVC pipe from sliding vertically? I didn't hear anything that mines the bottom of the PVC pipe. What would stop it from slowly sliding vertically upward or downward through the Dacron rope or through the so-called wire tie? Give me a couple of words on that one, Mel. Here we go. Greg, KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet. Wait 2 seconds beyond the beep.
Okay, there we go. Okay, basically what's happening with what's keeping it from sliding up and down, well, first of all is the wire tie. And what the wire tie is, it's just basically the plastic with the little teeth. It only goes around one way. You kind of slip it through and you draw it through, and it holds the wires in a bundle together. They come in multiple lengths. You can pick them up at Home Depot. They come in black, white. I use the black ones because they hide nicely in the tree. Those are, I think, 3/8 thickness, and they come like about a foot long. And it comes in a bag of like 60 or 70 of them. So I just use like two or three just to hold it in place. And I didn't really draw them very, very tight. And the thing that keeps the pole from moving up and down is that the tree limbs aren't aren't like tying two pipes together. It's not that kind of a machine finish. In other words, when you're tying a piece of PVC to a tree, the tree's got all kinds of knobs in it and bark, and when you start drawing a couple of wire ties against the bark of a tree, it kind of, the PVC kind of like forms to the tree a little bit, and it's a very strong friction device holding that 5 foot section, and then when you tie the Dacron rope around the outside, the PVC kind of tries to take the contour of the tree, if you know what I'm saying, Vic. Back over to you.
The word wire tie, I'm having a little bit of trouble with that one. I know what a tie wrap looks like. This is a plastic device you can buy either, you know, it's for cabling cables together, and it comes either white or black in color, and, you know, sometimes they use as a poor man's equivalent of a...
It's a tie wrap.
So you meant tie wrap. Is the tie wrap made out of plastic or made out of metal?
They're plastic.
Okay, now I understand. K2KEY, wait 2 seconds, beyond the beep, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. I faced that problem and I said, aha, got an idea. At the bottom of the PVC pipe in the tree, I made a slot in the pipe, right across the diameter of the pipe. Made a slot to accommodate the plastic tie. Now I have that, it sits, in other words, the bottom of the PVC pipe is planted on one of the branches. And to keep it planted on that branch, I just now put that piece of tie wrap, that plastic tie, around that branch, and I just pull up on it, don't have to pull tight. In other words, it just keeps it from slipping off that branch. Now, as Glenn just said, when I go up with the other ties, I just located a branch. In other words, it's on that pine tree. It's like at the V of the branches. So when you put a tie wrap around it, it can't slip down because the branches, that are coming out from the tree, will prevent the tie wrap. There's no way you can slip the tie wrap down, and because the PVC pipe, I guess they can't slip down any further because it's resting on a branch, on a bigger branch. And held there with that tie wrap, just the tie wraps going up, on every couple of feet, and not tight, no, they're just pulled up on, but they got play in them, and that's it, they can't slip over.
You know, I'm quite impressed. You guys have come up with a very crafty spring mechanism. The cantilever bending of an inch and a half or inch and three quarter PVC pipe. Very rugged, nice spring, lots of compliance, and it doesn't wear out. All the metal springs I've used, rust and fatigue fail and all kinds of nasty failure mechanisms. And pulleys and a brick, Paul has described that to us. That's also very troublesome. It's shown us some nice simple diagrams in the books, but you actually go and do it, you run into a lot of problems. This PVC pipe idea is a beauty. Did either of you guys worry about the ultraviolet protection of the PVC pipe? And I think there is a version that's made that's ultraviolet protected. But I guess in theory, in 15 years of ultraviolet exposure, you may get some slight depolymerization of the PVC. I'm going to turn it over to each one of you one at a time to say if you're worried about that, did you accommodate it, or am I worrying unnecessarily? KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet. Wait 2 seconds.
Dick, that's CPVC, chlorinated PVC pipe.
Is that automatically ultraviolet protected, Paul? Paul, is the CPVC automatically ultraviolet protected?
QSL, yes. The chlorinated PVC, CPVC, you can see it's a little off color. It's not as white. It's got almost like a little yellowish look to it.
Now, is that a special purchase, or is all the PVC pipe in my Home Depot that kind? Over to you, Paul.
No, I would go to Blackman and Shapiro, anywhere, any one of those places on the island to get that. I don't remember seeing it in Home Depot. They might have it, but you know, the common stuff that you see is just regular standard PVC, white PVC.
I've got a comment on that one.
Yeah, when it comes over to you right now, Glenn, Tell me, how did you get the idea? Is this a QIQ invention? Also, I'm going to be asking Mel where he got the idea from of using the PVC pipe in this springy mounting arrangement that simultaneously is a nice way of integrating the structure to the tree. Over to you, Glenn, K2RIW and the TechNet.
Well, I guess where I started working with the PVC deck was I was trying to make a support and getting away from metal with the wire antennas. So I thought I was a real smart guy by trying to use PVC pipe to replace a metal pipe. And as one learns very, very quickly when you try to do that, you have nothing more than a wiggly, wobbly fishing rod. And it doesn't stay up there. You can't get any kind of length. You try to put 2 10-foot lengths together, even a 2-inch diameter, and that thing just flexes all over the place. It's just absolutely worthless. So when I thought about finding a different way to anchor the dipole wires up in the trees, I was like, there's an awful lot of flexibility in a 10-foot section. Let me let it drop for a minute. And this way I could basically have a little support inside the tree to get away from the tree limbs, because when you try to hang wires in a tree, they always get snagged, and you wind up getting the wire caught in a limb and damaging the tree, and you never get it really in the spot where you want it tied off, and trying to maintain the pulley. And this way now you've got a nice little spring action inside there, a place where the pulley can hang, and there's enough area just to support the bottom 5 feet of a 10-foot fixed section where it seems to work pretty well. Now, as far as PVC goes, outdoor PVC that's used by electricians, the gray stuff, is actually UV protected. You can check it, and most of the stuff that's inside the Home Depot's, let me let it drop for a minute. The gray PVC that's being used for electrical, white is typically plumbing. That's the indoor stuff. You really shouldn't use that stuff outdoor unless it's specifically marked to do so. But the electrical PVC is the gray. And that you can get in almost any Home Depot, and you can look at and read the ratings that are right on the outside of the PVC, and it will tell you whether it's UV rated, and that's one of the things I look for. The same thing also with those little things I'm calling wire ties. You can also read on those whether those have UV ratings on them at all. And I can also tell you that from DX Engineering, their Dacron rope also is UV rated. It says it right on the package. Back over to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
That's a very nice arrangement. And when it comes to those gray outdoor rated plastic pipe-like things that are used for wiring, they also make a sweep where I think you could have possibly run the wire up the pipe and then use a sweep, one of these slow 90-degree bends at the top. And I think you could have run the rope through that, and maybe the friction would have been low enough with the right kind of rope that maybe a pulley wouldn't have been required. Give me a comment on that one before Glenn first. And then also, what diameter of this gray pipe did you use? Was it like 1¾ inches or 1½ inches, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet. Wait 2 seconds, be on the beat.
I found with the 12-gauge wire and the kind of wire lengths that I was running, I don't have any strands that, although the wire goes up to over 250 feet, in any one section, I don't have longer than 70-foot runs. And with 12-gauge wire and 70-foot runs, 1½ inch diameter works really, really good. So I haven't found any problems with 12-gauge wire and 1½ inch diameter PVC. Back to you, Dick.
So one other quick question. Do you consider using one of those sweeps as a way of running the rope through and therefore no pulley required, or do you think there'd be too much friction? It may have been slightly simpler if the sweep could have been made to work. Over to you, Glenn.
I actually tried using different things, insulators that were smooth, tried, I know what you're saying, like those 45 pieces. And the problem is, I imagine it could work, but like you're saying, there's a lot of friction. And when you're up in a tree and you're trying to get the wire away from, tree limbs and things, that little bit of extra Dacron rope between the eyelet and the pulley is also a benefit, because the rope that you're going to pull the wire up with and pull it into position through the pulley, It's good to have it a little bit just outside the limbs of the trees to get it up and away, if you follow what I'm saying, Vic. And the pulleys also, I got the ones that were galvanized from a marine store. As a matter of fact, when Mel was describing, he got the big marine pulleys. I was like, wow, yeah, those galvanized ones, that's exactly where I went to get mine, you know, a marine store. Back over to you, Vic.
And that extra little loop of rope, your pulley is how far suspended out from the PVC pipe? Glenn, go ahead.
In one of the trees that I have, it's almost butted right against it. I have, I think, like 2 or 3 inches because it's clearing, in other words, where that pipe top and the pulley kind of clears the limbs of the tree from that limb. It's very, very close to the edge over there, so I don't need a lot of standoff. But I have another tree where I have almost, I think, like 2.5 feet of Dacron before the pulley. And the reason there was just to kind of clear the pulley from the foliage, if you know what I'm saying, Vic. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Very crafty arrangement. Did you use ultraviolet protection PVC, and is yours also about 1.5 inches diameter, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, this is K2KEY. I think it's 1.75 inches, whatever heck it is. I don't know, what's the outside, like 2 inches something. Not just white PVC. I think they call it a Schedule 40 or some goddamn thing like that. I figured, listen, they use this for sewer pipe. I see all these new constructions here and houses. It's being all the sewer lines that they're running. You know, this whole house here, of course, is all cast iron with leaded joints. And how I see them putting together all these sewer lines all over the house, and they're using this white PVC, and they're tying it together with these rubber, you know, neoprene junk, you know, sort of what they call bushings with the stainless steel straps. I mean, that's how they make junctions and things like that, and well, glue it and all. And I say, gee, you know, sewers and everything, and it's standing up. What the heck could happen to it outside, you know, with plain rainwater hitting it? So I used regular PVC pipe, and so far so good. I don't see any deterioration in any PVC pipe I ever saw outside. In fact, you know, they make the fences out of that white stuff, which is, I think, a similar material. I don't see those plastic fences falling apart, Dick. Over.
WS2N.
Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, they were pretty much the reason they use the CPVC is because the UV gets to it, and then when it gets cold, it does not, it tends to fracture. So it's a fracture problem. I've seen stories about people putting their antennas on the PVC coming out of their, you know, the stack on there, in their bathroom coming out of their roof. You know, they'll put a couple of straps on there, and everything's fine, and the winter time comes along, and the next thing you know, it cracks on them. So it's usually a cracking problem. So for what Mel's doing, Schedule 40 is, it will never go. That'll stay there probably forever. And again, it's inside diameter, 1.5 inches. You know, they use numbers like that: 1 inch, 1.25 inch, 2 inch. They don't go by outside on that type of pipe.
Very nice to know. You guys have come up with a beautiful arrangement. Looks to me like it's a strong like bull. It'll survive what the tree's going to do, and a much better arrangement than the ones that I tried. All of mine kept coming down. Let's see if Tom is still there, because I know he had a question to ask. I think we've gone through the list of people who signed in. Yes, we did. Tom, if you're still with us, W2 Tango Juliet Tango, go right ahead and briefly tell us your question one more time. K2RIW in the TechNav.
By the way, Dick, I use 1.5 inches, little slivers of 1.5 inches pipe for insulation. The insulators on the dipoles.
Very crafty. Go ahead, Tom.
Okay, thanks, Dick. I didn't realize I was jumping into something out of subject. I'm looking to sweep an antenna, and I just want to know how to go about doing that. Like I said, I have a couple of UHF antennas, a couple of VHF antennas, They're max rads. They got a fiberglass outer shell, I think it's called a radome. And I want to bring it down to the frequencies that suit me. And a friend of mine said he sweeped it, and he got the antenna to work by doing so. I'm just not sure how to go about doing that. Back to you, Dick. This is W2TJT, Mobile in Brooklyn.
Wow, didn't realize you're mobile. You must be still talking to your car. Sorry to keep you waiting. When you buy an antenna analyzer, many of these antenna analyzers have a sweeping function to them. In other words, it'll sweep across the whole 80-meter band, or you can tell it what's starting frequency and what's stopping frequency. So built into the antenna analyzer, if that's what you're using, it's got a voltage-controlled oscillator. That means that you change the voltage going to the oscillator, it changes its frequency. So in theory, you could set it to, I'm just going to pick numbers, you could set it to sweep from 10 megacycles to 20 megacycles, and as it moves at each one of those frequencies, it's applying that signal to the antenna and looking at any signal that reflects from the antenna back. It's got directional couplers on the feed line coming out of the antenna analyzer, so it keeps track of how much energy or how much signal strength went forward and how much comes back. The magic of, let's say, a 50-ohm transmission line is that if the antenna at some of those frequencies presented a pure 50-ohm resistive load, then all the signal goes down the cable, gets absorbed by that load, and none of it comes back. The nasty characteristic of a transmission line, let me drop, is that if the antenna, the load on the far end of the transmission line, is anything but a 50-ohm resistor, if it goes down to 30 ohms of resistance or up to 75 ohms of resistance, that's a deviation. Or if it represents any kind of capacitance or inductance, which should be zero at resonance, but if it deviates in any way by adding capacitance to its impedance or a change in resistance, then a certain percentage of the signal flowing down the cable hits the antenna and reflects back. That's just the way a transmission line behaves. By measuring the amount of power reflected back and going to the right lookup table, it's called standing wave ratio. It really is the ratio of forward power to reverse power. So with the right kind of an antenna analyzer, and there's many ways of doing it, but antenna analyzer is one of them. Network analyzer is another one. You can find out what is the standing wave ratio at each of those frequencies of your antenna. You can plot it on a XY plot where horizontally is frequency and vertically is standing wave ratio, and you get a curve across that page. And now once you know what frequencies your antenna works well at and and frequencies it doesn't work well at, you've got a couple of choices. Number one, only use it at the good frequencies, otherwise your transmitter will probably be unhappy. That's one approach. Let me drop. Another approach is that if you're very crafty with doing antenna design or antenna modification, you can add inductors, add capacitors, add little pieces of metal in the right place. There's ways of disturbing the antenna, a slight redesign of the antenna, that will shift it from one frequency of operation to another frequency of operation. To retune an antenna lower in frequency, for instance, usually you add some length, and the length could be added length at the top. It could be an inductive loading coil at the bottom. It could be change of other things within the antenna. So if you're smart enough and you can do enough checking with the right books and the right people, there's a zillion ways of modifying an antenna to move it to a new frequency. And if you're even smarter yet, there are sometimes ways of making the antenna work over a greater bandwidth than it used to work, not only moving its center frequency, but changing the bandwidth over which it's operational. So with the right kind of instrumentation, where you know where you are right now, and you start tweaking with the antenna, and even if you tweak with the antenna just randomly, even if you had no real knowledge, When you make these modifications by adding copper tape in certain places and adding a capacitor, adding an inductor, adding a top hat capacitor, adding objects on the antenna, even when you do this tweaking operation, let me drop, as long as you're doing it in a non-destructive way, you can always come back to where you used to be. And while the antenna is connected to this antenna analyzer or network analyzer, while you retune it, if what you're doing is not an improvement, nothing bad happens. It's not going to explode. It's not going to catch on fire. You could put your hand across the antenna while it's connected to an antenna analyzer. Most antenna analyzers only feeding the antenna a few milliwatts of power, so it's a very safe operation. So you can walk over there and make these modifications to the antenna while watching the display, and you know when you're going in the right direction. So there's lots of ways of doing that. There's one exception to this rule. If the antenna is one of the station master type, collinear, vertical collinear antennas, which consists of four, five, or six individually vertically stacked elements, that kind of an antenna is extremely difficult to simultaneously move it to, let's say, a lower frequency, make it impedance match, and have the right antenna pattern at the same time. That kind of antenna, very, very difficult to move, and I don't recommend it. But other non-collinear antennas, almost all of them can be retuned to another frequency, and sometimes with relatively simple modification procedures. Maybe that's close to the answer you're looking for, Tom. W2 Tango Juliet Tango, K2RIW. My name is Dick. Wait 2 seconds beyond the beep, Tom.
Okay, basically, I have no knowledge of this. I need to acquire an analyzer. And it basically is, I open up the antenna, it's kind of a J-pole setup. And I'm thinking I might have to just shorten the main wire going up. And I guess I would have to mess with the shorter element on the side, the match, I guess it would be. But, all right, just an idea. But I definitely know what direction I have to go, so I definitely have to pick up an analyzer to see where I want to go. But, all right, thanks for remembering me, and I'll be hanging in there. I am mobile, so I'm not going nowhere, so I'll definitely be hanging in there. But I guess I got to do a little fool around, a little research, and I definitely got to pick up an analyzer to help me along with this project. Okay, back to you, Dick. W2TJT.
Tom, within the area where you live in Brooklyn, there are a couple of good-sized ham radio clubs. And some of those club members have the knowledge. Some of those club members have an antenna analyzer that you can borrow. You might not have to buy it. The Cadillac approach is to use a graphic type antenna analyzer. That gives you a continuous picture of what the antenna is doing at all of your favorite frequencies that you align it for on the antenna analyzer. You tell the analyzer what frequency to start and what frequency to stop in its analysis. It gives you a graphic display, and the graphic display tells you almost everything you want to know about how well the antenna is working. In the case of a J-pole antenna, moving it up or down in frequency, usually the first thing you do is to change the length of the radiating section. The impedance matching section, you do that second. But changing the length of the radiating section, that's the quickest way to move it up in frequency, you make it shorter, down in frequency, you make it longer. And there's various ways of doing that without making it physically longer, you're making it electronically longer. Let me drop. And as I said, doing it with an antenna analyzer gives you a beautiful graphic display in real time as you're doing the tuning procedure. You can get some serendipity there. You put your hand in the right place on the antenna and you see the display do something desirable and you say, gee, if there's a little more metal in this area, it would act that way and it doesn't have to leave my hand there. So with a real-time display, you get a nice, some serendipity happens occasionally. Now, That's the Cadillac approach, an antenna analyzer or network analyzer that you beg, borrow, steal, buy, or whatever. A slightly less Cadillac approach is to simply use a bird wattmeter with the transmitter that tunes to those frequencies. With the bird wattmeter, you measure forward power and reverse power at each of those frequencies and manually make your own graph. That's the cheaper way, or using a standing wave ratio measuring instrumentation. And then at each one of those frequencies, you measure the standing wave ratio and plot it on a piece of graph paper. So there's lots of ways of doing it. And where you live in a high-tech area there, Tom, within the Brooklyn area, lots of clubs, lots of ham radio operators. You'll get a hold of the right guy, and you'll get a solution pretty fast. As you start working on this problem, come back and tell us how the progress is going and what the final solution was on your MaxRed, I think it is, Max Radio antenna. And once again, what frequency is it on and what frequency would you like it to be on, Tom? W2TJT, K2RIW, my name is Dick, and wait 2 seconds beyond the beep.
All right, Dick, thanks, my business. Basically, I understand totally. It is a JPO configuration inside the fiberglass tube. I have one for 70 centimeters and one for 2 meters. The 2 meter one is more into the marine band, so I want to lower that to the ham band. So I guess I would have to shorten that a bit, the radiating element. And the same with the 70 centimeter antenna. But I'm not really too involved with too many of these clubs. I went down to a couple of the meetings over with Mel. Mel's helped me out a great deal with a previous project I've had with my 30L1 amplifier. He was a great help, very resourceful. But okay, I know what I have to do, and an analyzer would definitely be the way to go. So I would have to look for one of those on eBay. See what I could do. It's probably a good thing to have. My dipoles, you know. But all right, I definitely will get back to you and let you know how I make out, and all is good. Thanks, Dick. I'll be around. I'll get back to you. This is W2TJT. Thanks, Dick.
Good luck with that project, Tom. And you might decide to borrow an antenna analyzer from your ham radio buddies. One of the problems you might run into is that when you look up the available antenna analyzers, they basically come in two versions that I know about, VHF and HF. In other words, you can buy one that covers the VHF frequencies, you can buy one that covers the HF frequencies, and only the pretty expensive ones cover both bands at the same time. But I bet you Mel knows more about that. And how many dollars for each of those three types, Mel? And if you were him, considering the number of times you need an antenna analyzer, would you pay the big bucks to buy one, or would you try to borrow it? If you were in Tom's shoes, what would you do, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, in the case of antenna analyzers, they're fairly reasonably priced. You know, there's a number of them on the market now, very reasonably priced. To buy really sophisticated equipment, you know, like AEA puts out or antenna, some of them get a little bit on the pricey side. I know the one that I purchased went over $1,000, and you could no doubt buy antenna analyzers for less than half that today that would do the job, and it's a nice thing to have around. It's not something you're going to be using daily, but you want to check your antenna. You want to set up the tuner up, like I said earlier, without using the rig, and so you don't go crazy with the key down and all that stuff. The antenna analyzer does it. So, well, what can I say? It's a handy extra thing to have in a shack, like some other little gadgets to take over.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Glenn recognized, and if I wanted the Cadillac version for $1,000, Tom could buy a brand new 70 centimeter antenna or a brand new 2 meter antenna for quite a bit less than that. So should he just go out and buy another antenna as opposed to spending twice as much money for an antenna analyzer and then modify the antenna he's got is an interesting question. But I guess, like everything else, they're starting to come down in price. Let's see how Glenn solves the problem. KC2QIQ, 2 seconds beyond the beep. K2RIW, go ahead, Glenn.
But I'm just jumping in. That's a good point you made, that it really doesn't pay for me to buy an analyzer for that much money. I could just buy an antenna for a fraction of the price. But point well taken. If I do buy an analyzer, it would definitely be an HF analyzer. I'm definitely more into the HF bands. This is just a couple of antennas I have laying around, so I just wanted to, you know, make the best of them. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, let's see how Glenn would solve the problem. Go ahead, Glenn.
Well, I guess, Dick, what I do is right now, the only antenna analyzer that I have, I mean, I've got other ways of measuring antennas, but, you know, for this kind of purpose, I have an MFG 269. It does HF, VHF, and UHF. So it covers, you know, the 2 meter, the 70 centimeter band, and, you know, all the way down to HF. And is it a extremely accurate device? No, I'd say not. Is it portable? Does it have batteries? Sure does. Is it easy to recharge? Yep. Does it come with a lot of different fittings so you can connect it up to a lot of different antennas? Yes, it does. And when do I really use this thing? Most of the time it's antenna installation, whether it's a store-bought antenna or a wire antenna that I'm just kind of like, you know, putting out there. Let me let it drop for a second. Basically, what's happening here is I'm using this antenna analyzer every time I'm doing an installation. So regardless of what type of antenna it is, this way I know before I actually connect my radio up to it, I can check it at the antenna, like when I'm outside the house, and after I'm wiring everything up, is it double check just to see before I run the coax down into the house. Then when I come into the house, I can check it on the other end of the coax, see that I still have a good match there, or if I'm doing something in the car. You know, it's just a very universal kind of thing. Does it have to be super, super accurate? No, you just want to make sure that your antenna is functioning and in range. And if you have to make any adjustments or anything, before you connect up the radio. And that's generally what I use it for, Dick, most of the time. Back to you, K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
The one thing you didn't tell us, Glenn, your MFJ 269, when I buy it today, roughly how many dollars?
I bought mine a few years ago, but probably about 4 years now, 4 or 5 years ago now. Let's see, and it was around $300, somewhere in that area, and that came with the case, the rechargeable batteries, the charger, and a couple of other, you know, things that go along with it, which I thought was a pretty good deal at the time. And as I said, you know, every time I hook up an antenna, it's kind of like one of those things that always comes with me. So it's a lot of fun for that, you know, and it gives you just that little bit of added security before you connect up the radio that you did everything right. And I got to tell you, there's been quite a few times where I put something up and I thought I had everything right, and uh-oh, there's a problem. And you just go back and it allows you to double-check things before you actually connect up the radio, Dick.
And what's the lowest frequency and the highest frequency that the 269 will go to?
Right now it goes from 1.8 megahertz to, let me see, almost just under 500 megahertz, Dick.
That's a very nice frequency range. Okay, good piece of information. But for $300, Tom's got to consider that might be less than the price of the antennas he wants to replace, depending on which antennas he wants to buy. Okay. Let's go.
Comment though, Dick?
Go ahead, Glenn.
I guess you could always make that argument that, yes, okay, you can go out and buy another antenna, but here again, a lot of times you have an antenna that's a few years old, and you start developing a problem. You don't know what's wrong. And this way, it's a nice way to troubleshoot. You know, here again, maybe it's not the reason to go buy one, but certainly to borrow one for sure. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
thing to check your coax with.
So to check coax, to check antennas, it's a nice tool that's going to get used quite a few times, give you a warm, fuzzy feeling, and give you the ability to troubleshoot anything that ever fails in your antenna systems. And all of our antennas are going to fail. That's a given. Only thing left to find out is how bad is the failure, when is it going to occur, and what you're going to do to fix it. So maybe that's a tool worth having. I get away with a bird watt meter for 95% of that. And most of the time it solves my problem, but doesn't give me a graphic display. I don't get as much information, unless I'm willing to do quite a bit of work doing all the graphic. Let's go back to John, KC2 GWP, GWB, WGB. I'll make sure I get you right, John. Those guys on Staten Island, have we made any progress in defining energy in versus energy out in the case of a magnetic field? If this is the best of all worlds, to really find us out what's happening in a cyclic manner, it would be nice to be able to evaluate the energy going in as you push the magnet down, and amount of energy that comes back when you let the magnet come back up, and then do that some number of cycles and look at the in energy versus out energy. Would be nice to have. And I know that one of the other things that's difficult to explain is that when you push it in all the way some number of times, or leave it alone for 10 years, or push it in 1,000 times, in almost all cases it comes back to the exact same location. And how does a magnetic field do that? I think that's part of the mystery that you guys are sort of asking the questions about. Is that somewhat true, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I was just going to jump in and say, 7-3 guys, thanks for the help. Dick, Rich, Mel, have a good evening. And it's definitely worth for me to buy the 269 for the future. It's definitely going to help. 7-3 guys, take care. Have a good night. I'm out of here. W2TJT.
See you later, Tom. You've got it, John. Wait 2 seconds beyond the beep.
KC2WGB. I know it's getting late. I'll try to make it quick, Dick. Yes, you're describing exactly what we're trying to do. We're trying to find out why we can't measure loss in the magnetic field, because I don't know if this analogy is going to fit, but this is what I was trying to do. When I described the fulcrum with the lever and the solenoid coil, what I tried to do was hold the magnet at, didn't matter the height, but 3 inches, and I deducted the losses, which I accounted for in the coil. So if it was 30 milliamps to maintain this height, and 20 milliamps of that, just picking numbers, was the losses in the coil, that left 10 milliamps to suspend it. Is that equal to the amount of magnetic effect we're getting from the two magnets when they are holding it at the same distance? That's where I was going with that question. Let's hope you understand that.
I think I do. I'm going to give you some top-of-the-head guesses here. The energy you're losing in your electromagnet, a big factor is its resistance. Now you know why the large proton accelerator, large lepton accelerator, the big thing in Switzerland, runs on cryogenically cooled magnets. They're making a huge amount of magnetic field because they're trying to accelerate those particles as fast as they possibly can. And those particles want to go straight, and they got to force them into this circular path in that great big 27-mile diameter pipe. And they have the ability to keep adding energy to those protons moving in that particle accelerator. And there's no limit. They could keep adding energy on each cycle as they go around. And the only thing that limits is eventually they run out of the strength of the magnetic field they can generate. Therefore, they can't keep them in the curved pipe, can't keep them in that circle. The particles go to a larger circle, touch the side of the pipe, and the game is over. So they're using the strongest possible magnets they can realize. And in their particular case, they couldn't come close to making that level of magnetic field without cryogenic superconductivity, because their local power company couldn't supply the power fast enough for them to feed their electromagnet. So resistance loss in the wiring is a biggie. Let me drop. So accounting for that is not too difficult. Assuming you know with accuracy the resistance of your wire and the number of milliamps you're putting into it, I squared R tells you how much loss you've got there. Of the milliamps that are left over, depending on the number of turns, depending on the mu of the material, that's the bar magnet that is the electromagnet, depending on the reluctance of the total magnetic path, in other words, of the magnetic field that flows out of your electromagnet, it goes all kinds of places in space. Some of them are toward your horseshoe magnets, and some of them are leakage lines going all other places. You've got a total magnetic field structure around your electromagnet. Some of it's going into the horseshoe, some of it's going into free space. That total magnetic field, with those turns of wire, with that bar magnet in the center, has some amount of inductance. That's not an easy one to evaluate. And as the horseshoe magnet gets closer and further away, the amount of inductance is going up and down. By way of AC measurements, you could measure the inductance of your coil. You could measure the resistive component, the reactive component. You could figure out what is the inductance. Let me drop. And the total energy you put into an inductor is 1/2 LI squared. However, where L is the amount of inductance in Henry and I is the current in amperes. But as your magnet moves, your inductance, the total reluctance of the magnetic path is changing. Therefore, your total amount of inductance in Henry is changing. Is it changing a lot or a little? I don't know. But evaluating the total energy going in is a function of looking at the shape of that curve of current versus time as you charge that inductor, and it's a varying magnetic field, so that's a varying inductance, which makes a little bit of a degree of difficulty here, a significant degree of difficulty. And then when you start decreasing the current, in theory, a perfect inductor, I put some amount of current into it. If I've got a pure inductor that's a inductor filter choke that's part of a power supply, and my ideal inductor in my particular example doesn't change inductance as I charge it. It doesn't saturate at all. In my example, I know how much current I put in, over what period of time. I know the total amount of energy I put into it. It went into a magnetic field. If my inductor is high enough in quality, when I release the current going in, I could put it into a discharge resistor, or I could slowly lower the current from a constant current power supply and keep track of it. In theory, all of the stored magnetic field in an inductor, the 1/2 LI squared, all of it comes back to you if the inductor is high in quality. And if it has a given amount of resistance, in theory I can account for the amount of loss due to resistance versus the amount of non-resistive loss that went into the magnetic field and came back. So when you account for the loss mechanisms of resistance and the loss mechanism of eddy current as you're changing the magnetic field at some particular rate.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
As you're changing the rate of change of magnetic field, the rate tells you how much eddy current you get. And I guess you could do the experiment slow enough so that the eddy current loss goes to near zero. Once you really properly account for the way an inductor works, the energy you put in, magnetically speaking, and the energy you get back out should equal each other. And the only losses in between are, the major losses are I squared R loss of the winding and magnetic loss due to hysteresis. Other than those two losses, a good inductor should be near 100% efficiency on what you put in energy, in joules of energy you put in versus joules you get back out. Your case is more complicated because your inductance is changing because the gap length is changing, and you've got some frictional loss in that sliding mechanism that also has to be accounted for. In your particular case, the inductance energy you put in which sucks the magnetic field closer together or further apart, which is operating against the friction of a sliding mechanism, that's going to be one of the loss mechanisms of what you get back out. You've got a fairly difficult situation there, but I think you guys are crafty enough, you'll eventually get almost to the bottom of it. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet. You got it, John.
KC2QAQ with a com.
Yeah, let John go first, and then we'll go over to Glenn in a second. Go ahead, John.
Okay, Dick, you were confusing two processes. One is the two magnets. This involves just the lever on a fulcrum, and the solenoid will draw maybe 20 milliamperes. If I hang the magnet on it, I will need 30 milliamperes to hang it. So I just use that as a simple way to say, well, there was 10 milliamps with this magnet there, and I was trying to relate that to the magnetic properties of the magnet. Divided in two should give me the strength of the two magnets, one magnet, when they are in the opposing position. That's what I was trying to do. You understand that? I hope I'm explaining that right.
Okay. If I understand correctly, you've got one magnet that's glued to the table, so to speak, a horseshoe magnet, let's say it's aimed upward. You have a horseshoe magnet that's on a sliding mechanism that's operating with a lever. It's got a pivot point going to that magnet, which operates on a sliding mechanism. As you push down on that lever, you push those two magnets closer together. They're opposing each other. Now, also pulling on that lever is an electromagnet that pulls on the lever itself. As you...
Negative.
Okay, go ahead, John.
The track is one system. The lever on the fulcrum is only dealing with one magnet. There is no other magnet, and it's just holding it at the 3-inch level. So that is what the solenoid is doing, and the difference in the amperage was 12 milliamps unloaded, 30 milliamps loaded. Concept a little clearer?
Okay. In the case of the electromagnet is either on the bottom or the top, and there's another horseshoe magnet that it operates against, and there is a weight on that lever, and now you're measuring the amount of current to give you the same gap distance between magnet and electromagnet. Give me a few more words on that one, John.
Sure, Dick. It's just like a balance scale. The electric solenoid is at one end of the lever. Across the fulcrum, I hang the same magnet that was one of the magnets on the track. Does that make it clear?
You've described half of it. You've got a balance scale-like thing, which is a lever, pivot in the center, electromagnet on one side, permanent magnet on the other side, and the permanent magnet that's on the lever is operating against a fixed magnet that's on the table. Is that what you're saying? Go ahead.
Negative. There's no second magnet. It's just the weight of the one horseshoe magnet hanging on the lever, and the solenoid coil is only holding that magnet up. That's all it's doing. It's doing no work. It's just holding it in position.
Okay. I think the electromagnet is now giving you an opposing magnetic field trying to repulse the horseshoe magnet that's on the lever arm. If the horseshoe magnet was allowed to run free, in other words, if the electromagnet was not excited, I have the impression that the lever arm would tilt some number of degrees, bringing the two objects close together. When you turn on the current to the electromagnet, they get repulsed, and you measure that amount of force of repulsion. Is that what's going on? Go ahead.
Negative. It's a simple balance beam with a little mechanical advantage. The solenoid lever pulls down, the solenoid coil pulls down on one side of that fulcrum and holds the magnet up on the other. There is no other magnet involved.
Okay, there's a lot of missing ingredients in your mental picture you're describing to me. I know that the people who have been listening to all of the conversations earlier, they got a lot more exposure to this than I do right now. I'm being hit cold with this. Try to give me a complete description. I've got a lever arm, which you're saying is unbalanced. In other words, the pivot is not in the center. I had the impression that a A constant magnet is on one side. I'm not sure what's on the other side. And somewhere there's an electromagnet. And somewhere you're measuring distances and forces. I've got a lot of missing ingredients here. Go ahead.
Okay. I'll give you a description of the lever. We have a fulcrum. On one side, we have a 10-inch extension. The other side is a 1-inch extension, so we have a 10 to 1. A large magnet is on the 1-inch side. The electric solenoid is on the 10-inch side, so it needs a very little effort to